Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Protests erupted on the streets of Steubenville, Ohio this week over how officials handled accusations that some local high school football players had sexually assaulted a teenage girl last summer. Two young men have been charged in the case, but protesters claim the town is covering up for other among its players on the high school football team. All the media focus on this case has raised awareness about the issue of sexual violence and youth. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the culture of rape in our society, particularly as it pertains to youth. And what about the adolescence and sexual assault? Are things getting worse, or has reality been blown out of proportion by the incident in Steubenville? We can't help but be horrified by the news reports. But what are we doing now to manage the perpetrators of crimes such as those alleged in this case? Joining us now is Elizabeth Letourneau. She's an associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start out talking about what the incidence is. What do we know statistically about the youth segment of among perpetrators of sexual assault? Is it a large segment? Is it getting larger? What do we know?
We know actually some things we know really well. For example, youth perpetration of sexual assault, including peer assault and child sexual abuse, has been declining since the 1990s, and the decline is between maybe 30-50%. So we have had dramatic reductions in youth perpetration of sexual harm. So that's really good news. It doesn't get a lot of attention, and so I'm glad to be able to spread that. And you get those numbers, you find those reductions whether you are talking to victims, to conducting national surveys, or looking at juvenile justice and criminal justice records. So it's there across the board. But we do still certainly have far too many occurrences of sexual abuse in this country, and youth perpetrate a fair amount of that. And so adolescent boys account for maybe 30% of sexual offenses against their peers, adolescent girls, and a higher percent against younger children. So we know we need to be addressing perpetration of sexual harm by youth. We do very little to prevent that right now, and that's a big concern of ours where I work. But the news is good. The trends have been declining significantly since the 1990s in every year. And there's some excellent research out there supporting treatment effectiveness.
You said that we're doing far too little to prevent it in that category, that age group, that demographic. And yet,
right.
the statistics show us, or that what we know is that it's gone down 30-50% since the 90s. What do we know about why?
Well, it looks like the widespread implementation of anti-bullying programs across the United States in the early 1990s, which of course came about after some horrific, widely publicized mass school shootings, seems to have something to do with that. So we see these reductions in peer-on-peer youth sexual violence, and they co-occur with reductions in peer-on-peer physical violence. And so it's been hypothesized by David Finkelhor, who's been researching this for decades, that might be one reason that the anti-bullying programs are having an effect, kind of a spillover effect, because most of them don't specifically target sexual violence. I would actually like to see research, and I'm hoping to conduct some research, where we add modules to anti-bullying programs to specifically address peer sexual violence and child sexual abuse at the hands of adolescents. So that's one reason. And the other is that since the 1990s, there has been, you know, massive media attention to sexual offending and sexual abuse, you know, and so the entire country has really been keyed in on this type of offending for decades now. And I believe that's had the effect of, you know, some type of an educational effect, letting people know, hey, these things are bad, they cause harm. You know, there's been, excellent effort on the part of victims' advocates, on the part of feminists and others, to really bring sex offending out of the shadows and into the public eye since the 1970s. But I would say it was in the 1990s when the media became much more strongly involved in that. That can sometimes be a double-edged sword, but overall I would say that's been another part of the reason why these have gone down. And then we also have improvements in other child welfare indicators. Until recently there had been less children in poverty, fewer teen pregnancies, a lot of things indicating that, that the welfare of children in general has been improving. And when that happens, their involvement in criminal activity goes down.
My guest, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Letourneau. She's an associate professor at John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. If you have a question or comment for her regarding research into adolescent sexual assault and other violent issues, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And yet, Elizabeth, after all of you that you just said, and yet, not only do we have two boys charged, two young men charged with sexually assaulting this high school girl last summer, but we have the video that's now been very well circulated by the offshoot of Anonymous out there. This kid who apparently wasn't involved in the assault itself, but thought it was hilarious and had no compunction about referring to her as dead in many different iterations and basically reduced her to a lump of clay. And I'm wondering, with all that awareness out there and all those efforts by the media and the anti-bullying campaigns and everything, I can see the statistics going down, but I the behavior that was exhibited regarding this crime is very odd.
Well, I think that one thing that we need to keep in mind is a developmental perspective. So, you know, these are 16-year-olds, and 16-year-olds engage in awful behavior. They engage in delinquent behavior almost normatively. Rape is not normative, and it's not something that most kids engage in or experience as victims. But delinquent behavior is, and part of that is because developmentally these kids have got, you know, their brains are not fully matured. They have a very poor understanding of long-term consequences. They tend to focus on the short-term. Many youth are highly impulsive, really don't have a good sense of the depth of harm that they're engaged in. And so I think, you know, in this country in particular, we really view sex offenders as monsters, and we dichotomize things in a way that if you're a sex offender, you're absolutely unredeemable and horrible. And the problem with that is twofold. One is that when sexually abusive behavior is engaged in by people we know and love or respect, we miss it. We ignore it or we miss the red flags. You know, we saw that with Jerry Sandusky. We've seen it in countless other examples where people close to sex offenders who just can't conceive that they would engage in these kinds of behaviors because the behaviors and sex offenders have been so vilified, just either overlook or completely miss the red flags. And so, you know, this may have been the first time these boys engaged in this specific type of bad behavior, but probably not the first time they engaged in bad behavior, and maybe bad behavior aimed at girls. And so, but you've got folks missing these signs because these were kids who were well-liked otherwise, I assume. I don't know actually anything about this particular case, but in general, mm-hmm. we overlook signs because we view sex offenders as so awful that we can't conceive that someone we know, that we love, that we respect, somebody in our family or in our social circle could engage in these behaviors. So we either ignore the offending behavior or we kind of heap on the vilification and we call 16-year-old boys sexual predators. Well, they're not. They're very unlikely to go back out and commit another sexual offense upon apprehension. Most teenage boys who engage in sexual offending behaviors who are adjudicated never go back out and reoffend sexually. We've looked at data from the entire state of South Carolina, for example, across a 15-year period of time, so thousands of kids adjudicated for sex offending, and we found a 2.5% sexual reoffense rate. That meant that, you know, 97.5% did not go back out and reoffend.
Does that include those that sexually abused young children? So I guess
yeah, children,
fall into the
children,
pedophilia
peers, adults. Yeah, it was
okay.
Everybody.
Okay.
Kind of regardless of victim age or their relationship to their victims. And this has been found in other states as well. And so the recidivism or reoffense rates of adolescent sex offenders are very low once they've been apprehended. So that's, you know, that is heartening news. That's a good thing. These kids are not on some automatic trajectory toward turning into predators or sex offenders or pedophiles.
What about then the issue of the vilification that we're seeing them as villains versus as young men or older boys who are doing something, you know,
really bad. They did really bad. And then naughty versus ruined for life. Right. They're absolutely not ruined for life. Again, I can't speak to these two boys. I don't know them. I don't know any. But, you know, the best guess is, you know, supported by just reams of data, dozens of studies with long-term follow-up, is that they will not do this again. There's evidence-based interventions that have got, for example, 3 randomized controlled trials, the gold standard in clinical treatment, and in assessing clinical treatments. There's been 3 randomized controlled trials that demonstrate the effectiveness of a very intense but family-focused, community-based intervention for adolescents who have sexually offended, including committing egregious sexual offenses. And so we've got we have all this, but yet we still, you know, we see kids called sexual predators. We see them subjected to sexual predator policies. And so many states subject youth who are adjudicated for sexual offenses to long-term and sometimes lifetime sex offender registration, public notification, sometimes post-incarceration civil commitment, which is indefinite.
Mm-hmm.
And these policies don't work. We have good research demonstrating that these policies don't
work. Some are saying they don't work for adults either, that all adult offenses are not created equal either. It's absolutely another – I wanted to ask you –
That's another discussion. But the data are very, very clear. I mean, we have got now maybe a dozen publications assessing the effects of sex offender registration and notification in particular, when those are applied to juveniles. And not one single study shows any positive effect at all. And there are negative effects. And so we've got to look developmentally and make sure that we don't just assume that a 16-year-old, first of all, turns into an adult the minute he creates a horrific, you know, engages in a horrific offense. So that doesn't make sense. And secondly, that he's not on a trajectory to engage in this harm as long as we intervene effectively.
Real quick before I have to let you go, after the recent tragedy at the elementary school in Connecticut, there were rounds of criticism about violent images in the media, from computer games to Hollywood, and many dispute those notions, of course. But do the same issues come into play when it comes to sexual assault? Is there something to be said for this? There's no comparison to even 10 years ago what is available on the internet in terms of pornography and available on a lot of just regular old premium channels these days.
Right. And what I'll come back to are the data, the very clear data from multiple sources that peer-on-peer and peer child sexual abuse has been declining over the past 2.5 decades now, 3 decades. And so that's been, in hand-in-hand with the rise of the internet and all of these other cell phones and technologies. And so many people are really worried about what kids get exposed to. And I think that's very much a generational concern. Every generation looks back and says, you know, looks on in horror with what, their children get exposed to. And so I think that's a very common, very generational type concern. I certainly would support, personally, limits on video games that depict girls being raped or women being violated, because I don't think those are helpful images. But those are not the causes of sexual violence. For kids, the causes include who you're hanging out with. Is it a violent culture of your peers that encourages violence both against girls and boys? Do you have a lot of unsupervised time after school that allows you to get into trouble? Are you unmonitored? Are you insufficiently monitored by adults? Do you have a poor connection with your school? Are you impulsive? These are the kinds of things that get kids in trouble and that are associated with all sorts of delinquency and that we know we can intervene effectively with. And so I think concerns about youth exposure to violent images and youth engaging in things like sexting with their phones and other things are not quite on target. I think the target really needs to be, what do we know encourages delinquent behavior, including sexually delinquent behavior? And we have those answers to some degree. We know how to intervene effectively. And how can we get society to sort of not lump kids with adults? So a 35-year-old who rapes, an unresponsive 16-year-old is simply not the same kind of person as a 16-year-old who does it. And we need to be developmental in our approaches and do everything we can to make sure victims and perpetrators reach their positive potential and go into an adulthood, with the best chances of succeeding.
Elizabeth Letourneau, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Elizabeth Letourneau is an associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Coming up, we'll talk to a couple of experts in preventive education and for sexual assaults and regarding sexual assault. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Recent attacks in India and Steubenville, Ohio have put rape in the headlines. But how much of what we think we know about rape is riddled with myth and misinformation? I'm Celeste Headlee. What we know about rape, who does it and why, who the victims are, and who reports it. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 34 degrees with partly sunny skies, a high of 46 today. Rain showers moving in this evening with rain likely overnight, a low of 43. Showers and maybe a pop-up thunderstorm for Friday, and warm, a high near 60. WOSU is supported by the McCoy Center for the Arts. National Geographic tornado hunter Tim Samaras will detail his harrowing job with scientific tidbits and footage from his adventures in the field. A show for all ages, Sunday, January 13th at the McCoy Center in New Albany. More at mccoycenter.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. Congress recently failed to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. The act provides federal money for a variety of projects aimed at helping women and children who suffer from abuse and also to fund outreach and education on issues of sexual violence. It was first passed in 1994 and has been reauthorized twice. Here to talk about that and more things, still with us, joining us now is Monika Johnson-Hostler. She's president of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. Welcome to the show, Monika.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Sue Wismar. She's Prevention Education Coordinator for the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio. Boy, that was a little slip, huh, Sue?
Thank you for having me.
First, Monika, the Violence Against Women Act was left to, wither away during the last congressional session. What do we make of its future? Can it be revived? Is there any kind of reflection on that in terms of what happened in Steubenville last August?
Yes, thanks for asking. I'm an optimist, and even if I wasn't in these political times, I think we all should be. Just in transition in this country's kind of political awareness and astuteness, I think, has been heightened in this country, and especially given the number of congresspeople who have made comments about rape and sexual violence. I'm actually surprised we were not able to get the Violence Against Women Act reauthorized. As you stated, it has been reauthorized twice since it was enacted, and both times it's been bipartisan, bicameral support without any problems. And last year we did have some difficulties with that, but I do believe, there's lots of reasons to believe that we'll be able to revive it and it will be reauthorized in the 113th Congress.
But what was your sense about it? Were they just distracted by fiscal cliffs and so forth, not to mention a presidential election?
No. Quite honestly, each VAWA has built on the next VAWA, so there were expansions to this Violence Against Women Act that was more inclusive to all women in all communities, and given that there was a lot of conversations and differences in how that would be addressed in both the House and Senate versions of the bill, and time did just quite frankly run out to really come to a joint decision around how we protect Native American women, LGBTQ communities, communities of color, and immigrant communities who were not adequately addressed in the previous VAWAs.
Now, the act, as I mentioned earlier, provided funding. What about that funding? What happens to that?
So, what I can't speak to what a positive outcome of positively say this with 100% confidence, mm-hmm. but what I can tell you is historically, acts that are not reauthorized still can be appropriated as long as the appropriation has not expired. And so the Violence Against Women Act, as far as we know, can still be appropriated because it has not expired. So that means when Congress does pass a budget or if they pass another continuing resolution as they did last year, the Violence Against Women Act can currently still be appropriated.
Now, Monica Hassler, your phone probably started ringing off the hook last week when this came to light, a la the anonymous group. Mm-hmm. You've seen it all, I'm sure. What was your initial response to what you saw and heard?
So I've been doing this work for almost 20 years, and I was shocked. And I say I don't shock easily, having done this work for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think my shock was because what I do know, and I cannot agree more with Elizabeth Letourneau, who was on before me from Johns Hopkins, our youth do see, bad behavior as normative. And so while we know that it is much easier for youth to practice in what I would consider in this case horrendous comments about this young woman, we do know developmentally that's where youth are, but it was still extremely shocking that there were that number of people involved and that number of people who witnessed it who did not step in as bystanders to at this point that we know of to stop it or to alert an adult that this was going on. And that, I think for me, that was most disturbing.
Sue Wismar, when we were talking with Elizabeth Letourneau earlier, she mentioned this decrease in sexual violence among that age group, that older teenage mm-hmm. group, I guess is what we're talking about. And she credited things like anti-bullying campaigns and that sort of a thing. When you're doing your job as prevention education coordinator for the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio, how much does bullying come into your message?
Bullying is actually part of our comprehensive prevention program, because as a prevention program, we're trying to build up protective factors that protect people from the likelihood of perpetration and also from the likelihood of victimization, but more of a focus on preventing perpetration. And the roots of that are the same roots that a lot of prevention programs have for anti-tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs. Anti-teen pregnancy, keeping children in school to complete high school.
What are the roots that what connect
some
all
of those?
Those
roots? While a lot of our work is in boundary setting, so being able to assess what our boundaries are, being able to express them, being able to defend them, and we consider self-defense, like physical self-defense, as a very final extreme of those defenses. But these are all skills that need to be built, and they're built in small ways. Another skill set that we try to build would be the spectrum of bystander intervention, which means that somebody can understand that I can recognize that this is a problem, that I recognize that it's a problem that deserves action, that I am responsible for that action, and then also how do I implement that safely. And a lot of failure for bystander intervention in extreme cases, like we see in Steubenville, it is a lot of things, but one of those aspects would be not understanding those four steps about how we engage an entire community to address a problem. And that's having everyone believe that I do have a role to intervene, I know to intervene, and I know how to intervene safely.
Monica Johnson Hassler, we've been talking about the bystander issue for a couple decades now, since some movies came out, really.
Right.
And it was encouraging, if you listened very closely to that video, that there were other boys in
there
the background saying, hey, buddy, that's mm-hmm. rape you're talking about.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and there were some definitely, even using what I would consider As Sue just mentioned, we definitely have stronger bystander trainings in helping people understand how to intervene safely. And so I would say I definitely was able to hear some of the young men in the background use the old reference, which this could be your mother, your daughter, mm-hmm. your wife or your daughter in 10 years. However, again, I don't think what we have not been able to do is that they clearly intervene with that kind of language, but they don't have the tools at this point to safely intervene, to actually have something to happen to stop the violence. And so I think that speaks to where Sue was going with strengthening and making sure communities know how to engage safely and with the right tools.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Monica Johnson-Hassler. She's president of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence, and she's also executive director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Also with us in the studio, Sue Wismar. She's president prevention education coordinator for the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio. If you have a question or comment for them, you're welcome. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Monica, to what extent is youth sex violence a part of your work and a part of the conversation you're having every day?
So again, referring back to Elizabeth's earlier comments, mm-hmm. I mean, our work in the anti-sexual violence field is across the lifespan. And so youth sexual violence has always been paramount to the work that we do because, as she mentioned, starting from early childhood with child sexual abuse is where our work begins. There have always and still is, although declining, youth perpetrators of child sexual abuse as well and peer-on-peer. So it's definitely a part, integrated part of our work and extremely important. I mean, one of the things that was a new part of the Violence Against Women Act, the last iteration 5 years ago, was really focusing in on evidence-based work around engaging men and boys, especially young boys. And there was also a huge emphasis on engaging coaches and other adults who have responsibility and leadership and accountability over young people. And so not only is it a paramount part of my work, but we also made sure it was included in the way that we addressed and allowed funding for the last reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act.
A big issue in the Steubenville case is the prominence of high school athletes in the community, and that there's allegations that coaches knew, or at least one coach knew about this and told them to delete all their information and so forth. What do we know about that connection with athleticism and athletics and so forth and these kinds of acts?
So what we do know from Dr. David Lisak's work is groups like athletics, fraternities, or any subculture of men who, come together that create their own culture has, like any other culture, its norms, norms and normative behaviors that exist in those subcultures. And looking at his research, which actually, quite frankly, honestly, was on a college campus, but not very far-fetched to talk about the way it relates to these young men in high school, that when you have a culture that has its own norms and values that are set by the people engaged in that culture, there are things like a code of silence. There's privilege that come along with being seen as elite, such as these young men were in their community, because not only were they football players in a large football community, but in those kind of context, those athletes are often seen as your leaders, whether it's in your school or in your community, that people look to as leaders and hold leadership, meaning that they often influence their peers as setting the standard. And so we know that those cultures also come with some very positive norms, but we also, in this case, see some of those negative norms that are a result of those subcultures.
Once again, if you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A lot of what has shocked the world about the Steubenville incident, such as we know it at this point, is that it was the subject of rampant gossip before it became national news. For months it was, Sue Wismar, and girls were as much a part of that gossip chain as the boys were, by far. They had the whole rape crew. Everybody knew about it. What do you tell girls to raise their awareness about these kinds of conversations and what they really mean?
Well, I think that Monica brought up a really important aspect when she just spoke, talking about the subculture of any small group, but that the privileges that go along with it and the status. And for violence to occur in any realm, sexual or otherwise, it's the abuse of some sort of privilege or power. Whether that's because you have power and privilege as an adult over a younger child, professional authority and power, or physical power over somebody, you know, or the power of being sober while somebody is inebriated. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you bring up, and it seems shocking initially that women would participate in language and victim blaming that that harms all women and all victims, regardless of gender, seems shocking. But if you look at it through the lens of power and privilege, why would it be shocking that somebody who experiences less power joins up with the voice and the sentiment of people who do have power?
So they can side with right. the more powerful.
Right. Why wouldn't I? I mean, also an idea of kind of being indoctrinated to that, you know. I'm being told by all people with power, all men with power, and other women who seem successful with power, that this is the line that you toe you need to conform to this to have power. And so I'll do that as well. I've been told my whole life that it's my own fault if someone perpetrates against me. And so I'll continue to say that.
Monica, any thoughts about that?
I completely agree with Sue. I mean, the other piece of that, going along with that, is also we oftentimes see victim blaming on both sides, whether it's male or females. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I would also say that would be a contributing factor for me in considering that there were young women who were also engaging in this town gossip.
Mm-hmm. One issue we haven't brought up specifically is the idea of the social media aspect of it. We wouldn't know about any of this if it hadn't been posted and if it hadn't been recorded on somebody's smartphone and then put on the internet. Monica, is this a good thing that we're able to learn about? I mean, is the internet in a way, in social media, in another way, a good thing that they're getting more exposed?
So this is what I would say about social media. Social media is just like any other tool that we've had. It just so happens to be the 21st century tool. So it was the TV, you know, radio, all of those things I think are tools that we've used to get quicker information about what's happening, whether that's news, good or bad. And so I think social media in this particular case, I would never have known about it. I live in North Carolina, but I'm the chair of the National Alliance. Ohio would have responded. Both Sue's organization as well as her statewide coalition would have been only people responding. And so I think in this case what it has done is increased the awareness for people to say, wow, this is not just happening in one community, but Steubenville, Ohio is representative of communities across the country. And so in that way, yes, social media was used as a tool to increase awareness of the prevalence and the fact that sexual violence can happen in any community to any person. On the other hand, the way that it was used or misused by those young people who recorded it on their smartphones or, you know, captured pictures and immediately are able to upload it, I think for young people, which goes back to their brain development, that just aren't thinking about when you do something immediately that it has long-term repercussions. So erasing it, I think they all learned a valuable lesson. Erasing it today, once you've uploaded it, people still can have access to it. And so with the quick, fast nature of social media, I think it is the adults' responsibility to start talking to our young people about the long-term implications. And so I wouldn't say social media was a good or bad thing in this case, but mm-hmm. I think it definitely has different outcomes.
Talking with Monica Johnson-Hassler, she's president of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence, and also Sue Wismar is the Prevention Education Coordinator for the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Bye.
Barry Lopez is best known for writing about the natural world, but he goes deep into his own inner life in an essay about how he was abused by a pedophile over a period of 4 years and how that affected the course of his life. Lopez's essay about confronting the trauma of sexual abuse is in the January edition of Harper's. We'll talk with him on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Sustaining givers are the future of our station. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. For example, $5, $10, or even $20 per month can be charged to your credit card. Then your membership is always active and your member card renews automatically. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer and sign up today. Partly sunny and a high of 46 this afternoon, a chance of rain this evening, with more rain likely overnight, a low of 43. Showers and even a thunderstorm possible for Friday. Mild temperatures, though, a high of 60 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from the Wellington School, where children are encouraged to discover and develop their unique potential in preschool through grade 12. Wellington will host a visit day for prospective middle and upper school students on Monday, January 14th at 9 a.m. More at wellington.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're discussing sexual violence in our culture, particularly among adolescents. What are the causes and how can we prevent it? And what role does the depiction of women in the media play in this? Still with us is Monika Johnson-Hostler. She's president of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. Monika, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us in the studio is Sue Wismar. She's the Prevention Education Coordinator for the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio. You can join the conversation 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's an interesting statistic put forth by the National Institute of Justice. I might have seen it on your website, Monika. It says that crime victimization costs our nation $450 billion a year, with rape being the most costly of all crimes to its victims, $127 billion a year. And that's not counting the child sex abuse category. What costs so much?
Well, as you know, crimes cost us both financially and emotionally, not just to the victim, but to the communities as well. But included in that particular piece of research that you're referring to includes things like such as lost wages, because we are talking about adults. Survivors of rape that were captured in this research. But so it's lost wages, it's child care, it's hospital care, it's the cost for any treatment or therapy that that survivor may also need.
Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome, Gail.
Yes. I would like to propose the idea that it's not just in this country that a lot of rape that goes on it's a cross-cultural, it happens in all cultures. It's basically misogyny. I mean, look in India, this woman was gang raped on a bus, and the bus driver knew it, and then they threw her out on the street like a piece of garbage. And again, in Pakistan, this young woman, Malala, she had the temerity to stand up and want education for girls in Pakistan, and she was shot in the head. And in China, if they have, and you know, the one-child policy, if they have a girl, it's not all over. But in certain parts of China, if they have a girl, they kill it because they want a boy. So my stipulation is that it's not just, you know, it's not just rape. It's a cross-cultural thing about misogyny,
which is the hatred of women.
Yes, the hatred of women. Cross-culturally, I mean, there's honor killings in India, and it goes on and on and on until men can get their head around the fact that women are their equal and not, you know, and not cringe in fear of women learning bringing themselves up. You know, I don't know what it is. It's just like what are they afraid of? You know, that's what gets me. It's not just this. it's not just this country, it's cross-cultural.
Sue Wismar?
I think Gail brings up something wonderful and insightful, that this isn't a new age of social media. It's not a new age of the exposure that our children have right now to sexualized images or violent images, but that this is a all of time in history occurrence of violence against women, of hatred towards women. I think the problem is, for our prevention education programs now, what we need to do is look at the root causes of what are these dynamics of power that people hold over each other. And we can't dismantle them until, as Gail kindly said, she kindly said, until men turn their heads around. And I think that more pointedly, it's until we acknowledge that the work that has to happen is that we investigate the aspects where we have power and privilege, and where we set those aside to offer them up to the people that we are stepping on in order to keep that power. And until men decide to look at all their power and say, I'd prefer to have less power, which is a very difficult place to come to when you experience power all the time. And that's really our fight. And that's why it's so difficult to get into schools, to do education programs that are talking about root aspects of our culture in ways that might not express themselves directly as in physical violence right away, but that we're talking about our language, talking about the ways we treat each other and the ways that we use power. And people in power aren't so interested in sharing.
Monica?
There's nothing I can add. Both Gail and Sue summed it up. I completely agree.
An email from Karina. She asks, as a parent, what can I... And by the way, Gail, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. Thank you. Email from Karina, as a parent, what can I tell my son about not being a bystander? Are there any programs for boys and how to be a strong, caring young man? Monica?
So what I would say, and Sue can speak to kind of the work that she's doing specifically in mm-hmm. Ohio, but there are definitely evidence-based trainings and programs that are being developed across the country and implemented both in high school and college and adult people, both men and women, on how to be a bystander and what that means. The thing that I think is most difficult with this with sexual violence that looks a little different, and I think all of us have kind of alluded to this, that the anti-bullying campaign touched on but didn't go far enough, and it sounded like Elizabeth knew or was planning on doing some further research on this, but that is, sexual violence is an issue that most of us still hold near and dear to sex, which is a private taboo subject. And the thing that I always remind people is sexual violence is not sex. It's a violent forced behavior. And so it is something we should be talking about. And so I think that what we have not done is across the country and globally, to Gail's point, is really talk about what everyone's role is in intervening. And so while those programs are newer and just starting to be implemented across the country in pockets where people are willing to look at their own value systems around power, because that's what's going to be required for us to be able to have access to implement these bystander trainings that do exist.
An email from Robert. He says, implicit in today's discussion is what constitutes being an adult and what constitutes the stage or stages of life before then. Obviously, this is not just a characteristic of age. Perhaps a brief discussion of this might be relevant to the program. Now, Elizabeth Letourneau did get into a little bit about the developmental stages. Right, Monica?
She did. She did. And I think, you know, so to your emailer's point, and going back to Elizabeth, which she spoke far more eloquently than I can, having been engaged in the research herself, but these were young men, and the young man who recorded the 12-minute video, I'm not sure how old, I don't know the specifics, but I've read different accounts that he was not a teenager. He had actually graduated. But either way, you know, brain development research shows us that your frontal lobe is not fully developed until you're 25. And so should these young men be held accountable? Absolutely. Are they the same as an adult? No, not brain development-wise, they're not, which is what Elizabeth spoke to. And so one of the things that she talked a lot about is we've seen that juveniles and youth can actually stop the trajectory of being the monster or the language that people are using for these football players in this particular case. But the reality that she said that I want to point out is those we saw those things change for youth who were adjudicated and received evidence-based appropriate treatment. And those are the things that I think are necessary to change the trajectory of the lives of young people like the boys in this case. Is those things have to happen. Adjudicated meaning there is absolutely accountability and also receiving evidence-based appropriate treatment.
You know, you were talking about values a little bit earlier, Monica, and as a culture, we show our value for jobs and people by what we pay them. And 60%, I check that is from your website again, or it's from the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence, right? 60% of rape victim advocates earn between $20,000 and $30,000 a year, and half of them in the country receive no benefits for what they do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. I mean, oftentimes people don't note the work that we do. And one of the things that I'll shed light on to this as well is, so nonprofits that provide this service to communities, whether it's prevention education, such as Sue, who's there with you, or it's the direct service advocates who answers the crisis line and goes to the hospital and law enforcement and court accompaniment with survivors of sexual violence, are professionals. And so the thing that I think that we've done as a country is assume that this is an all-volunteer way that we are addressing sexual assault survivors. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. If we the things that we hold near and dear, and I will personally say I'm married to a teacher, and I say that, you know, we value education, but we pay them poorly as well. And so I often remind people that when a society truly values and understands that violence against women is unacceptable and is the responsibility of every one of our citizens to be engaged and hold accountable, then the more we will see and value the work that rape crisis centers and sexual assault advocates do across this country and pay them well, because the only way to actually change the culture that we live in, and that's the larger culture where rape has been and is permissible in globally, because we have not valued the importance of intervening with bystander intervention, nor have we valued the work that people do to support survivors in sexual violence.
Georgia and Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Georgia.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that in spite of all the talk about bystander awareness and so on, I don't think any woman can count on anyone but herself to keep her from being a victim. And I think it's very important to train girl children from the moment they're born to walk like they know what they're doing, have a purpose about them, some self-confidence, and self-defense training, because nobody is going to save us but ourselves.
You know, Sue Wismar, some people might respond to that with, yes, but do you want them to make them fearful at a very young age? You know, you get into the whole idea of when is it appropriate to introduce these ideas to a child? And how do you respond?
That's interesting. You know, children are targeted for victimization from the moment they're born. So at what point do you let them know that that's been the case? I don't know. I don't deal with self-defense training for elementary youth. There are programs in Ohio that do skill building in preschool age. and I definitely agree that the core of self-defense is about understanding your value and your boundaries. And I think that that's a skill that everyone gets to learn. And I think that the more people that hear the message that this human being has value, just as I have value, would do great wonders for us decreasing violence. The one thing that I always, I want that to happen at the same time that I want the foundation cultural changes to be made, because we talk about no one should be in charge of saving me but me, and I wholly agree. I love the idea of knowing that I can defend and protect myself, and I think that's valuable. But as the renowned self-defense instructor Deb Shipper would make the analogy, we profess all sorts of risk reduction behaviors. And if any woman actually adhered to all of these risk reduction behaviors, don't walk out at night, don't ever leave your house at night, so after 5 p.m. in the winter, you know, you're most likely to be assaulted by someone that you know. So don't be friends with males knowing that there is a fraction of female perpetration. So lock yourself in a basement, you know, whatever. But even in a smaller scale, you know, never drink a drink that someone else purchased for you. And if you were out at a bar with a colleague from work or a new boss or something like that, and you go to the restroom and you return and they have a drink waiting for you, a coffee even, and you drink that drink and it was spiked, now the whole world looks at you and says, why would you? Why would you drink a drink that you didn't see? You know you don't drink a drink that you haven't seen be brought to you. And that victim blaming occurs. But our attitudes are such that we at once say victims are responsible for avoiding victimization. And on the flip side of that coin, we look at them and we say, you're absurd and paranoid for talking about sexual assault, for being so vigilant all the time. If I return from the bathroom with my new coworker and there's a drink there and I say, I'm sorry, I'm not drinking this because I don't actually know you that well, or I've only known you for a few months, then it's, you're a psycho weirdo, you know? And so there is no winning unless we change that foundation that that at one time says it's a big problem and it's all your job to take care of, and on the other side, you know, quit talking about it. Quit talking about power and privilege with men. You're a man-hater.
Mimi, in Steubenville, you're on the air. We're running out of time. I wanted to squeeze you on. You said that your nieces experienced sexual harassment in high school?
Yes, and they're her friends. They were her friends.
What?
And she's been prepared. She's been taught.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You know, we were talking about
it. It doesn't necessarily matter what you teach them or how much you talk to them.
Because
and she can defend herself.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about sexual harassment, tell me what you mean by that.
I mean she was attacked.
Okay, sexually assaulted.
Yes.
Okay.
And by two brothers.
How's she doing now?
She's dealing with it, but she's been taught she can defend herself, and it wasn't a situation that she put herself into.
Let me ask you.
They were friends of hers.
Is she still in high school?
Yes, she switched schools.
What do you make of what's happening in Steubenville? Was this a surprise to you as much as it was to everybody else outside of the city?
Yes,
or
it still is, and it's not really necessarily public knowledge, but you know, the parents didn't do a thing about it. You know, they were told about it, and nothing's being done. Nothing. Mm-hmm. There was a police report made. Nothing's being done about that either.
Well, there's two of the kids have been charged. We do know that. They're going to go to trial, I think, next month. But, well, Mimi, I'm sorry for your niece. Thanks for sharing your insights today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Take care. And thanks as well to my guests, Monica Johnson-Hostler, president of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence, and also the executive director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Monica, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, and thank you for covering this issue. Mm-hmm.
And Sue Wismar, she's prevention education coordinator for the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio. Sue, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins, and with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And you can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.